The landings at Cwm Cale continued throughout the day. By 5:30 p.m. all men and artillery were ashore. French forces consolidated their position in Cwm Cale to face Turkish troops massing in the neighbouring town of Yene Şehir. As night fell, the Turks mounted the first of four attacks on French positions. Bayonet charges gave way to intense and confused hand-to-hand fighting. Casualties on both sides mounted. While the French were able to retain their hold on Cwm Cale, they began to question the wisdom of attempting to take Yene Şehir. Their occupation of the Asian coast was meant to be temporary, and every casualty in Cwm Cale meant one less fighter to reinforce the British on the Gallipoli Peninsula, where they would be most needed. On the morning of 26 April, a party of 80 unarmed Ottoman soldiers, Greeks and Armenians, advanced towards French lines under the white flag of surrender. They were taken as prisoners of war. Shortly afterwards, hundreds of Turkish soldiers walked openly towards French lines, though these men were armed, with bayonets fixed. The French, believing the soldiers intended to surrender, allowed the men to approach to persuade them to lay down their arms. A French officer, named Captain Roquel, went forward to negotiate and disappeared into the crowd, never to be seen again. Turkish soldiers took advantage of the confusion to penetrate French lines and take up positions inside the occupied village of Cwm Cale. Others jostled with French soldiers and managed to seize two machine guns. When word of the situation reached the French commander, General Albert Damade, he ordered his troops to open fire. The French found themselves under fire from houses behind their own lines and shooting into groups of mixed French and Turkish soldiers. It was total chaos. The French fought into the early afternoon to recover Cwm Cale, bombarding the houses held by Turkish troops. The French summarily executed a Turkish officer and eight soldiers in retaliation for the, presumed, killing of Captain Roquel under the white flag of a parley. By sowing confusion, the Turks had confined the French to Cwm Cale and inflicted heavy casualties on the invaders. As French losses mounted and the British need for reinforcements in Helles grew more acute, the Allied commanders decided to withdraw from Cwm Cale on 26 April. Under the cover of darkness, all French troops and materiel were re-embarked, along with 450 Turkish prisoners of war. On the morning of 27 April, they crossed the straits to land at V Beach, via the now secure landing jetty attached to the River Clyde. French forces in Gallipoli were stationed on the right, or eastern, side of Allied lines, overlooking the Straits of the Dardanelles, and the British were concentrated on the western part of the line, overlooking the Aegean. Together, they consolidated a front line to challenge strong Ottoman defensive positions that lay between the invaders and the strategic high ground of Achi Baba, which dominated the southern reaches of the Gallipoli Peninsula. The first wave of Australian troops set off for the Araburno coast at dawn on 25 April. Their intended landing site was a stretch of beach to the north of a rocky promontory known as Kaba Tepe. However, the planners had once again miscalculated the strength of the currents off the Gallipoli coastline, and the steam launches with their tows of four landing craft drifted well off course, landing a mile or more north of the landing site in a small bay to which the invaders gave their name, Anzac Cove. The sailors guiding the tows had difficulty working out their positions in the early morning light against an unfamiliar coast. This meant that the troops, when they landed, faced a totally different landscape than planned, and an extra ridge to scale to reach the high plateau. The confusion resulting from this mistake would plague the Anzac landing for the rest of the day. Ottoman sentries spotted the lighters as they approached the shore. Journalist C.E.W. Bean, who accompanied the Australian force as official historian, noted in his diary the time, 4:38 a.m., when he first heard the sound of rifle fire from the shore. First a few shots, then heavy and continuous. The landing parties felt exposed as they neared the shore, jammed together like sardines in the boats, while the Turks blazed away merrily at us from the top of a big hill just skirting the shore, one Australian soldier in the first wave recalled. The soldiers were in a hurry to get out of the landing craft as they watched their comrades killed and wounded at random around them. Once the men were ashore, the carefully scripted battle plan began to unravel. The landing craft, carried off course by the current, had not only landed in the wrong place, but in the wrong order. Soldiers were separated from their commanding officers, and units got intermixed. Under fire and fired up, the Australian soldiers fell in with the nearest officer, fixed bayonets, and began to charge up the first ridge of hills to drive back the Ottoman defenders. As one Australian infantryman wrote home, "The lads cheered every inch of the way, which I really believed helped to dishearten the Turks, for when we got near the top, they jumped out of their trenches and ran like old Harry to their second line of trenches, a distance of half a mile or more." The quick and successful bayonet charge gave the Australian troops a false sense of confidence, for the Ottomans were already beginning to prepare to repel the invaders. Mustafa Kemal Bey had his headquarters within a few miles of Anzac Cove. When he first heard about the landing, the Ottoman commander dispatched a cavalry squadron to observe and report back. At 6:30 a.m., his commanding officers issued orders for Mustafa Kemal to dispatch a battalion, roughly 1,000 men, against the invaders. Drawing on his own intelligence reports, Mustafa Kemal knew he needed to deploy an entire division, about 10,000 men, to repel an invasion of such magnitude. He gave orders for the Ottoman 1st Infantry Regiment and a mounted battery to prepare for battle before heading off in person to assess the situation at the front. 8,000 Australian soldiers had landed at Anzac Cove by 8 a.m. At 10:45, the 1st New Zealand troops reached the shore. The invaders had faced heavy opposition in the northern and southern extremities of the landing sites, where well-entrenched Ottoman gunners deployed shrapnel and machine guns to lethal effect. One tow, landing to the north, was devastated by machine gun fire, and only 18 of 140 men reached the shore uninjured. Those landing closest to Gaba Tepe faced intense shrapnel from Ottoman batteries in the heights. Yet, by mid-morning, the main body of Anzac forces had secured the central stretch of beaches and driven the Ottoman defenders from the first and second ridges overlooking Anzac Cove. While making his way to the front, Mustafa Kemal encountered a group of retreating Ottoman soldiers who had run out of ammunition. He ordered them to fix bayonets to their bulletless rifles and hold their position. The Ottoman commander correctly assessed the vulnerability of the Anzac position. Though they had managed to land a large number of soldiers, the Australians and New Zealanders held an unfavourable and very wide front, cut up by a number of valleys which were obstacles. For this reason, the enemy was weak on nearly every part of his front. Moreover, Mustafa Kemal had great confidence in the fighting power of his soldiers. As he organized his troops to counter-attack, he reflected, "This was no ordinary attack. Everybody in this attack was eager to succeed or go forward with the determination to die." The strength of the Turkish riposte caught the Anzacs by surprise. Just before noon, strongly reinforced, the Ottomans commenced a desperate counter-attack, supported by military and machine guns, and having our range to a nicety, they gave us the hottest time of our lives, an Australian soldier later wrote. As fresh New Zealand soldiers reinforced Anzac positions, the invaders entrenched and settled down for a firefight that raged incessantly the whole night through. Ottoman forces had the benefit of mobile artillery and rained shrapnel and machine gun fire on the invaders, who began to suffer very high casualties. New Zealand Corporal Mostyn Price-Jones shared all of his illusions about the adventure of war in his first day of combat. Landing at mid-morning, his unit advanced up a steep valley under a hail of shrapnel. "Our men were dropping one after another, but then gamely stuck to it, finally gaining the firing line." Jones was demoralized by the growing number of casualties. "You cannot possibly imagine how horrible it is to see your chums and comrades, just before laughing and joking, dropping round you with all kinds of horrible wounds." By the end of the day, only 86 of 256 men in Jones's company made roll call. The rest were dead, wounded, missing, or simply divided from the rest of their unit by the chaos of Anzac Beach. As the day wore on, a growing number of isolated soldiers abandoned the firing line to return to the coast. Having left their heavy packs on the beach in order to scale the steep slopes overlooking the landing site, the soldiers, hungry and thirsty after an intense day of fighting, were also running low on ammunition. These tired and demoralized men made their way down the main valleys to the beach below, soldiers reduced to stragglers. The Turkish defenders took every advantage of the confusion and disarray among the Anzac troops. In perhaps the boldest initiative of the day, a group of Ottoman soldiers penetrated Australian lines, pretending to be Indian troops serving in one of the British Imperial units. As the Australians were expecting a detachment of Indian reinforcements, the Turks' ruse worked better than they could have dared hope. Word came down the line that a party of Indians had arrived and requested a meeting with one of the Australian officers. A lieutenant named Elston, accompanied by an interpreter, went along to meet the Indians. They asked for a more senior officer to discuss matters, and an adjutant named Captain MacDonald was sent to join them. Presently a message came that they wanted to see the colonel. When the commanding officer, Colonel Pope, arrived, he found Elston and MacDonald in parley with six soldiers who had rifles and bayonets fitted, and began to suspect a trap. As the colonel approached the group, the Turkish soldiers closed round the Australians. Pope managed to escape under fire, but Elston, MacDonald, and the corporal were all taken prisoner, a coup reported in the Istanbul papers the following day. The Australian journalist, C.E.W. Bean, fascinated by this story, noted, "How easy it would be for any Oriental to dress up as an Indian and come along the beach. Not one of our men would have distinguished him." By the end of the first day, some 15,000 Anzac troops had landed around Aribono. They had suffered a casualty rate of 20%, with 500 dead and 2,500 wounded. They had sent every available man into battle and had no fresh soldiers in reserve. In the course of an intense day's fighting, the Anzacs had secured a beachhead, but had not managed to achieve half of their objectives in the face of determined Ottoman defence. As the valleys and beaches filled with stragglers, the Anzac commanders believed their position was growing untenable, with insufficient soldiers left to hold their front line. Were the Ottomans to mount a major counterattack the next day, the Anzac commanders feared, the chances of preventing a disaster were remote. Weighing their options, the commanders decided to request boats to evacuate all soldiers for Maraburno. Sir Ian Hamilton, commander-in-chief of the expeditionary force, met with his commanding officers through the night of 25 to 26 April to consider their options. The Allies had suffered very heavy casualties, though they had managed to complete the landings. Although none of the landing parties had achieved the high ambition set for the first day, Hamilton believed the worst was behind them, now that all of the Allied soldiers were ashore. By all reports, the Ottomans, too, had suffered heavy losses and were being made to divide their forces to fight the Allies at several points simultaneously. By securing their positions, the Allies hoped to wear down the resistance and morale of the Ottoman defenders. Any attempt to re-embark Anzac forces, a two-day operation, would have the opposite effect, encouraging the Turks and leaving the retreating soldiers vulnerable to Ottoman attack. Hamilton decided to decline the Anzac commander's request to evacuate their troops. "There is nothing for it but to dig yourselves right in and stick it out," Hamilton explained. "Make a personal appeal to your men, to make a supreme effort to hold their ground." To reinforce the point, Hamilton added in a postscript, "You have got through the difficult business. Now you have only to dig, dig, dig until you are safe." To compensate for the lack of field artillery, Hamilton ordered the fleet to open fire on Turkish positions beyond Anzac trenches to give the Australians and New Zealanders time to consolidate their positions. As the sun rose on 26 April, the dreaded Turkish counterattack did not materialize. Both sides, it seemed, needed time to reorganize before returning to battle. From the first day of the ground war in Gallipoli, the Ottomans and invaders proved remarkably well matched. Both sides showed tenacity and courage in what was a first experience of battle for nearly all participants. Yet the events set in motion on 25 April would demand far more tenacity and courage in the months of terrible violence yet to come. and the commanders on both sides would face difficult decisions, balancing the deployment of troops in the Straits against other pressing demands for forces on other fronts. For the Allies, the Western Front was always the higher priority. For the Ottomans, the Dardanelles would take top priority as key to the Empire's struggle for survival. Yet the Ottoman war planners did not enjoy the luxury of concentrating single-mindedly on the defence of the Straits. The Young Turks faced urgent demands for military resources on several fronts at once, especially in the Caucasus, where Russo-Armenian cooperation threatened the Ottomans in a region of particular vulnerability. In addressing that threat, the Young Turks would resort to means for which they have been accused of crimes against humanity down to the present day. 7. The annihilation of the Armenians. By the spring of 1915, the Ottomans faced invasion on three fronts. Since their conquest of the Basra region of southern Iraq in the final months of 1914, Anglo-Indian troops had posed a grave threat at the southern gates of the Ottoman Empire. In the east, the Ottoman Third Army was in total disarray in the aftermath of Enver Pasha's ill-conceived Sarakamush campaign against the Russians in December 1914 and January 1915. To the west, British and French fleets had mounted sustained attacks against the Dardanelles, and Allied infantry had managed to secure several beachheads on both sides of the straits. There were good grounds for the panic that swept the imperial capital in March 1915. The Empire's collapse appeared imminent. With the onset of spring, the respite provided by winter's natural defences was coming to an end. The deep snows of the Caucasus had started to melt. The winter gales in the Aegean had given way to calm and stable conditions in Gallipoli. The Ottomans' enemies were once again on the move, and by April 1915, the Empire confronted the gravest combination of challenges in its history. The Young Turks had very limited means to confront these concerted threats. They struggled to rebuild the Third Army to defend the Caucasus against Russian attack, while concentrating every available unit for the defence of the Dardanelles, leaving almost no regular forces to repel the British from Mesopotamia. The Ottomans mobilized their population for total war, stepping up conscription and deploying police and gendarme units to reinforce regular infantry. The gendarmes were a mounted rural police force. Enver's secret security force, the Teşkilat-i Mahsusa, mobilized Kurds, Bedouin tribesmen, and released prisoners to serve as irregulars. And when, in the spring of 1915, the Young Turks declared the entire Ottoman-Armenian population a dangerous fifth column, the Unionists even mobilized average citizens to assist in their annihilation. In the aftermath of defeat by the Russian army at Sarakamush, the survivors of the Ottoman Third Army were devastated by an invisible enemy, disease. Between October 1914 and May 1915, as many as 150,000 soldiers and civilians in northeastern Turkey succumbed to contagions, far exceeding the 60,000 Turkish soldiers who died in the Battle of Sarakamush. Soldiers carried a host of infectious illnesses. After weeks of exposure to the elements, their immune systems gravely weakened. They contracted typhoid and dysentery from the contaminated food and water they scavenged. The unwashed soldiers were infested with lice and fleas that carried typhus. While billeted in towns and villages in eastern Anatolia, Ottoman soldiers infected the civilian populations. Passing from soldiers to civilians and back again, these lethal diseases spread, reaching epidemic proportions in the opening months of 1915. The Ottoman medical authorities in Erzurum, already struggling to treat the wounded, were totally overwhelmed by the sick. As the military hospital provided only 900 beds, the authorities were forced to commandeer every school, mosque, and government building in Erzurum to accommodate the sick and wounded. Up to 1,000 new patients were admitted daily, with the total number of sick patients in Erzurum reaching a maximum of 15,000 at the height of the crisis. Food and medical supplies were rapidly depleted, compounding the miseries of the sick and wounded. Patients sometimes went 2 or 3 days without food. In Erzurum, soldiers actually died of starvation in hospital. Nor did the authorities have sufficient firewood to heat these improvised medical facilities in the dead of winter. These conditions contributed to the plight of the sick and wounded, and to a shockingly high mortality rate. The American Missionary School in Erzurum was converted into a 400-bed facility that the medical missionary Dr. Edward Case found more conducive to the spread than the treatment of disease. The patients were densely packed into rooms with straw mattresses on the floor, making it impossible to isolate or quarantine those who were contagious. Without disinfectant or other sanitary measures to combat disease, the hospitals themselves rapidly became the centres of transmission. Between December 1914 and January 1915, Dr. Case reported as many as 60,000 deaths, civilians and soldiers combined, in Erzurum, this in a town whose pre-war population numbered only 60,000. Nor was Erzurum unique. The American consul in Trabzon estimated that over the winter of 1914 and 1915, between 5,000 and 6,000 soldiers and civilians had died of typhus in the Black Sea port town, where local doctors claimed the mortality rate from the disease reached 80% at the height of the epidemic. These conditions put medical workers in as much danger as their patients. At one point, between 30 and 40 doctors were confined to the contagious hospital in Erzurum, according to Dr. Case, all sick with the typhus, nearly half of whom, or more, died from the disease. After 2 months in these insalubrious wards, Case himself contracted typhus, though he did recover. Case was more fortunate than many. The U.S. consul in Trabzon claimed that over 300 doctors and medical personnel died in northeastern Turkey between October 1914 and May 1915. As more medical personnel took ill and perished, there were fewer available to treat the sick and wounded, whose suffering and mortality increased accordingly. The dead weighed heavily on the living during the winter of 1915. Dr. Case described the horror he witnessed in Erzurum. The dead were so numerous they forbade their burial by day, and at night they were carried naked by the wagon load to the trenches, their clothing having been taken from their backs. I saw a trench, or rather a large hole, half filled with dead bodies in every position, just as they had been thrown in like rubbish and half uncovered, their heads, arms, legs, and even parts of their bodies showing. Others were later thrown in on top of them, and all covered up. It was a terrible sight to see. Case even saw dying men being laid in mass graves to expire where they would be buried. Faced with the sheer magnitude of the dead and dying, the living were losing their sense of compassion. Medical Corporal Ali Riza Eti, who had served at Sarakamush, was posted to the Erzurum Military Hospital at the height of the epidemic. He was made chief orderly of the quarantine section when the previous incumbent contracted typhus. Eti found the work exhausting, and given his exposure to hundreds of men with contagious diseases, dangerous. He applied repeatedly to be transferred to a different job without success, as more sick and wounded crowded the hospital, filling beds vacated by those who had recently died. After his time at the front, Eti knew and sympathized with these men. He grew increasingly angry at the suffering of the common soldier, and he came to focus his anger on the Armenians as scapegoats for Turkish wartime suffering. Already in his time on the Sarakamush front, Eti had developed a deep hostility towards the Armenians. He regularly accused them of disloyalty to the Ottomans, of crossing lines to join with the Russians, and of providing the enemy with information on Ottoman positions. He had reported the accidental deaths of Armenian soldiers by their fellow Ottoman soldiers with seeming satisfaction. But only while serving in the hospital did Eti have the opportunity to act on his deepening hatred. The death of a soldier from Eti's hometown proved the catalyst for his rage against Armenians. The wounded man told Eti that he had been evacuated from the front only to be abandoned in an isolated ditch by an Armenian orderly in the transport corps. After 2 days in the extreme cold, the Turk suffered frostbite to both hands and feet. The medics in Erzurum tried to save the man's life and amputated his limbs, but he died the next day. Imagine how contemptible the Armenian soldier was, who had abandoned the wounded Turk in a ditch, Eti raged. Could we be brothers and fellow citizens after this war? For my part, no. It is easy for me to take my revenge. I will just make 3 or 4 of the Armenians in the hospital drink poison. Corporal Etty resorted to cruelty rather than murder in his personal campaign against the Armenians. In January 1915, he abused his position in the medical service to dismiss and banish Armenian workers. I dispatched 3 Armenians, one from Van and one from Diyarbakir, to be stripped and robbed, that is, by rural marauders who usually killed their victims. "This is what you call Turkish revenge," he gloated. He fired 4 Armenian women and replaced them with Turkish women. "And I assigned the most dangerous tasks to Armenian orderlies," he noted with grim satisfaction. Though he never claimed to have actually killed an Armenian himself, Ali Riza Etti clearly wished the Armenians dead. Nor was he alone. Defeat at Sarakamish and the devastating impact of contagious disease had left the Ottomans more vulnerable on their eastern front than ever. The divided loyalties of some Armenians had tarred all Armenians in the eyes of many Turks. The young Turk leadership began to contemplate permanent solutions to the Armenian problem. In their short time in power, the Young Turks had overseen massive population transfers. Territorial losses in the Balkan Wars had driven waves of destitute Muslim refugees to seek shelter in Ottoman domains. Without the resources to address this humanitarian crisis, the Turkish leadership created space for the Balkan refugees by deporting thousands of Ottoman Christians to Greece. A government committee then oversaw the reallocation of the houses, fields, and workshops of deported Ottoman Christians to resettled Balkan Muslim refugees. These population exchanges were regulated by formal agreements concluded between the Porte and the Balkan states, ethnic cleansing with an international seal of approval. The deportation of ethnic Greeks from the Ottoman Empire served several purposes. Deportation not only freed up homes and workplaces for the resettlement of Balkan Muslim refugees, but also allowed the Ottomans to expel thousands of citizens of questionable loyalty. Tensions over the Aegean Islands that threatened renewed war between Greece and the Ottoman Empire in the first 6 months of 1914 had left Ottoman Greeks vulnerable and exposed. The population exchanges initiated after the Balkan Wars had provided an internationally sanctioned solution to the Empire's Greek problem. What started as a controlled exchange of border populations between belligerents evolved into a systematic expulsion of ethnic Greeks from Ottoman lands generally. Though there are no precise figures for the deportations, several hundred thousand Greek Orthodox Christians were forcibly relocated before and during the First World War. The deeper into Ottoman domains the deportations were conducted, the more the government had to rely on violence and intimidation to achieve its aims. Greek Orthodox Christian villages in western Anatolia, far from the troubled Balkans, resisted the state's efforts to uproot them. Gendarmes rounded up villages, beat the men, threatened to kidnap women, and even killed Ottoman Greeks who resisted deportation. Foreign consuls, appalled by the violence against Christian civilizations, reported dozens killed in some villages. Yet the expulsion of Ottoman Greeks could be carried out with relatively low levels of killing, because there was a Greek state to which they could be deported. The same could not be said of Ottoman Armenians. A minority in every province of the Ottoman Empire, the Armenians were concentrated in 3 areas of particular sensitivity during the First World War. Istanbul, threatened with imminent Allied invasion, was home to the largest concentration. In Cilicia, overlooking the Gulf of Alexandretta, the Ottomans suspected the Armenian community of making common cause with the Allied fleet. In the Caucasus, a minority of Armenian activists compromised the standing of the community as a whole when they allied themselves with Russia against the Ottoman Empire. The Young Turks believed the Armenians posed a far greater threat to the Ottoman Empire than the Greeks, because some Armenians hoped to create an independent homeland in Ottoman territory with Allied support. One of the Ottoman government's first acts after entering the First World War was to abrogate the February 1914 Armenian Reform Agreement with Russia. The agreement called for a reorganization of the six easternmost Ottoman provinces bordering Russia into two administrative units under foreign governors to provide an autonomous homeland for the Armenians. The Ottomans had opposed this reform agenda, which they viewed as a prelude to the partition of the Turkish heartland of Anatolia, a plan to create an Armenian state in lands with a sizable Muslim majority under Russian patronage. What they had signed under duress in February 1914, the Ottomans were relieved to annul on 16 December of the same year. In the aftermath of defeat at Sarakamish, the Young Turks began to consider extreme means of addressing the threat they believed Armenian national aspirations posed to their territory. In February 1915, Dr. Bahadin Shaka, operational chief of the Teşkilat-i Mahsusa and a member of the Committee of Union and Progress, CUP, Central Committee, returned to Istanbul from the Caucasus front. Armed with reports and documentation gathered in the field, Shaka met with the powerful interior minister, Talat Pasha, and another Central Committee member, Dr. Mehmed Nazım. Shaka spoke of the necessity to address the enemy within because of the oppositional stance that the Armenians had taken toward Turkey and the assistance that they were affording to the Russian army. Though there is no transcript of their meetings, those contemplating atrocities seldom leave a written record, Ottoman documents and contemporary memoirs suggest these three young Turk officials made key decisions initiating the annihilation of the Armenian community of Turkey between February and March 1915. The hapless Armenian community of Istanbul played into their enemies' hands by the open show of support they gave to the Allied campaign against the Ottomans and Germans. Grigoris Balakian was an Armenian priest studying theology in Berlin in 1914. When war broke out in Europe, Balakian wanted to return immediately to Istanbul. The Armenians in Berlin tried to dissuade Balakian. "Many advised me to go to the Caucasus and join the Armenian volunteer groups and then cross over into Turkish Armenia with an invading Russian army," he recalled. Balakian wanted nothing to do with the Armenian brigades in Russia, which he saw as a threat rather than a support to Armenian communities in the east, but his friends in Berlin dismissed Balakian's concerns. Caught up in their nationalist sentiment, they were loath to miss this unique opportunity to redress the wrongs committed by the Turks against the Armenian people, Balakian recalled. On his arrival in Istanbul, Balakian made a point of telling the Ottoman immigration officials that he was returning from Berlin and expressed his support for the German war effort and Turco-German relations. One customs official, who warmed to Balakian's expression of loyalty, counseled the Armenian priest, "Effendi, give your compatriots in Constantinople, whose views are completely opposite yours, a little advice so that they will renounce their love for Russia. They have gone to such extremes in their affinity and love for the Russians, French, and English, that on the day that the Russians win, the Armenians smile, but when the Russians have been defeated, they are sad. This much sincerity will cause them much trouble later on." Within days of his arrival, Balakian was concerned to see the custom official's observation vindicated by the Istanbul Armenians' open display of support for Allied wartime successes. With the onset of the Allied attack on the Dardanelles, the Armenians made no effort to hide their celebration of imminent delivery from Turkish rule. After all, weren't the mighty English and French fleets already in the Dardanelles? Balakian asked rhetorically. And after all, wasn't Constantinople on the verge of falling in a couple of days? He watched in dismay as Armenians gathered each day in anticipation of witnessing the majestic British fleet pass toward the Bosporus, its mission to save the Armenians, of course. Balakian claimed his compatriots believed that the historic hour had come for the realization of their age-old national dreams and hopes, leaving Ottoman Armenians in a state of unprecedented euphoria, at a moment when Ottoman Turks faced an existential threat. It was a formula for violence. Already in Cilicia, Talat Pasha and his colleagues were initiating the first measures against the Armenian community. The area around Alexandretta was particularly vulnerable to naval attack, as the HMS Doris had demonstrated by shelling railway lines and rolling stock in Dyrtyl and Alexandretta in December 1914. Allied warships continued to blockade and bombard the Cilician coastline and had deployed spies ashore. Armenian activists were suspected of assisting these foreign agents and providing information on depleted Ottoman troop numbers across the region. Minister of War Enver Pasha followed these developments with mounting concern. "My only hope is that the enemy has not discovered our weakness in Cilicia," Enver confided to German Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg. Unable to raise the number of Ottoman troops in the region, Enver and Talat opted to forcibly relocate the suspect Armenian communities instead. In February 1915, the Ottomans began to deport Armenians from Dyrtyl and Alexandretta, in Turkish Iskenderun, to the Adana region. On the model of the Greek population exchanges, Muslim refugees were then resettled in the forcibly vacated Armenian properties. The deportations relieved Turkey's security concerns in the Gulf of Alexandretta. However, no provision was made for the welfare of the dispossessed Armenians, who were forced to rely on their co-religionists in Adana to survive. The state's indifference revived memories of past massacres, and fear swept the Armenian communities of eastern Anatolia. Activists in the village of Zeytun, some 65 miles northeast of Dyrtyl, responded to these first deportations by plotting an uprising against the Ottomans. In mid-February, a group of Armenian rebels travelled from Zeytun to Tiflis, Tbilisi in modern Georgia, to seek Russian arms and support. They claimed to have as many as 15,000 men ready to rise up against the Ottomans. Many still lived in the flawed belief that a full-fledged rebellion might prompt an Allied intervention on the Armenians' behalf. However, the Russians were in no position to deliver arms, let alone send troops, to assist the Armenians in Cilicia, so far from their own frontiers. At the end of February, an anxious group of Armenian notables from Zeytun alerted the Ottoman authorities that activists were plotting a revolt. The Christian leaders hoped, by this show of loyalty, to protect their community from attack, but their revelations only served to unleash the very reprisals the Armenians most feared. Ottoman soldiers were dispatched to Zeytun to conduct mass arrests. Many young men fled their homes for the countryside, where they joined growing bands of Armenian rebels and army deserters, preparing for a confrontation with their government. An armed Armenian band ambushed Ottoman gendarmes near Zeytun on 9 March, killing a number of soldiers. Reports vary between 6 and 15 killed, and taking their weapons and money. The attack served as a pretext for the total deportation of Zeytun's Armenian community. Soldiers sealed off the town and placed its Armenian notables under arrest. Between April and July, every one of Zeytun's Armenians was deported to the central Anatolian town of Konya, and Muslim immigrants were resettled in their place. Stripped of their possessions and given little or no food or protection along the way, over 7,000 Armenians were left homeless in Konya. Some 1,500 of the Zeytun Armenians died from starvation and disease that summer, before suffering a second deportation to Syria. On the eve of the Allied landings in the Dardanelles, in April 1915, Talat Pasha and his colleagues shifted their focus from Cilicia to Istanbul. They aimed to decapitate the political and cultural leadership of the Armenian community in advance of a possible invasion of the capital, to prevent the Armenians from making common cause with the invaders. Turkish police arrested 240 notables, politicians, journalists, members of Armenian nationalist parties, professionals and religious authorities, in a nighttime sweep on 24 April. They worked from a blacklist compiled with the assistance of Armenian collaborators. The knock at the door came late at night. Many of those arrested were still in their nightclothes when they reached prison. The Armenian priest, Grigoris Balekian, was one of those arrested on the night of 24 April. He, like all the others, was caught by complete surprise. Policemen escorted him to a blood-red bus, waiting in the street below. The captive priest was taken with 8 of his friends by ferry from the Asian to the European districts of Istanbul. "The night smelled of death. The sea was rough, and our hearts were full of terror," he recalled. Balakian and his fellows were deposited at the central prison, where they met up with other Armenian detainees. They were all familiar faces, revolutionary and political leaders, public figures, and non-partisan and even anti-partisan intellectuals. Busloads of new arrivals joined the group through the night, in a state of spiritual anguish, terrified of the unknown and longing for comfort. The next day, the Armenian detainees could hear the distant reports of Allied cannons supporting the Gallipoli landings, and wondered if the ominous thunder would spell their doom or their delivery. For Armenians, the arrest of the political and intellectual leadership in Istanbul on 24 April initiated the systematic destruction of the Armenian communities of Anatolia. The date has since gained international recognition as the Armenian Genocide Memorial Day. For the Ottomans, however, the war against the Armenians had begun 4 days earlier, with the Armenian uprising in the eastern Anatolian town of Van. Van was a major market town divided into Armenian and Muslim quarters. Lying near the shores of Lake Van, the old town was a walled city with 4 gates, built against a massive outcrop of rock rising 200 metres above the plain. A citadel, built by Suleiman the Magnificent, crowned the promontory and dominated the town. The narrow, winding streets were lined with 2-storey houses that gave on to markets, mosques, and churches. There were a number of government buildings in the southeastern part of the town, along with a police station and gendarmerie. In the course of the 19th century, Van spread beyond the walls of the old city to the fertile lands to the east. Orchards and high mud-brick walls surrounded the houses in the garden district. A number of foreign consulates, British, French, Iranian, Italian, and Russian, as well as the Catholic and Protestant missions, had taken premises in the garden district. It was a remarkably cosmopolitan mix for a provincial town whose population a French demographer estimated to number only 30,000 souls in the 1890s, 16,000 Muslims, 13,500 Armenians, and 500 Jews. The townspeople shared a strong sense of civic pride. Gergen Mahari, a native son, described Van as a miraculous green-haired enchantress from a fairy tale, in his classic novel, Burning Orchards. The Armenian community in Van and the surrounding villages was large and politically active. Given its strategic location near both the Persian and Russian frontiers, it was inevitable that Van would prove a flashpoint between the Ottoman state and its Armenian citizens. The governor of Van was Chevdet Pasha, a committed unionist and Enver's brother-in-law. In March 1915, Chevdet ordered gendarmes to search Armenian villages for hidden weapons and to arrest anyone suspected of bearing arms against the empire. These searches led to violent pogroms against Armenians in the villages surrounding Van. In a bid to decapitate the leadership of the Armenian community, Chevdet allegedly ordered the deaths of 3 leaders of the Armenian nationalist Dashnak party in Van. 2 of the Armenian leaders, Nikolaos Mikhailian, better known as Ishkhan, the Armenian word for prince, and Arshak Vramyan, a member of the Ottoman parliament, were murdered. The 3rd leader, Aram Manukyan, mistrusted Chevdet and chose not to respond to an invitation from the governor to call on him in his offices. When he learned of the disappearance and presumed murder of his 2 comrades, Aram went underground to prepare the Armenians of Van to resist imminent massacre. Rafael de Nogales was a Venezuelan soldier of fortune who volunteered for the Ottoman army more out of a sense of adventure than from conviction. Enver Pasha met de Nogales in Istanbul and offered him a commission in the depleted 3rd Army shortly after the defeat at Sarakamış. In March, the Venezuelan reached the 3rd Army headquarters in Erzurum, where officers were more concerned with fighting typhus than the Russians. Eager to see action, de Nogales volunteered for the Van Gendarmerie, the only unit then engaged in active combat on the Russian front. His journey from Erzurum to Van took de Nogales through the tense conflict zone between Ottomans and Armenians. He arrived on the day the Armenians of Van rose in revolt against Ottoman rule. On 20 April, de Nogales and his escort came to a stretch of road on the northwestern corner of Lake Van, strewn with mutilated Armenian corpses. They could see columns of smoke rising from the villages on the south shores of the lake. Then I understood, he later wrote, as if the event had long been expected. The die was cast. The Armenian Revolution had begun. The following morning, De Nogales witnessed a brutal massacre in the Armenian quarter of the village of Adulgevaz, on the north shore of Lake Van. Ottoman officials, assisted by Kurds and the rabble of the vicinity, broke into Armenian homes and shops, systematically robbing and killing all the men. When De Nogales, wearing the uniform of an Ottoman officer, approached an official and demanded that he put a stop to the killing, he was astounded when the man replied that he was doing nothing more than carry out an unequivocal order emanating from the governor-general of the province, that is, Chevdet Pasha, to exterminate all Armenian males of 12 years of age and over. As De Nogales had no authority to override the orders of a civil official, he withdrew from the massacre, which went on for another 90 minutes. From Adulgevaz, De Nogales crossed Lake Van in a motorboat, reaching the village of Edremit on the outskirts of Van after nightfall. Burning villages that bathed the sky in scarlet lit the shoreline. Edremit was a war zone, its houses and churches in flames, the smell of burning flesh in the air and the rattle of gunfire punctuating the roar of destruction. He spent the night in Edremit and witnessed running gun battles between Kurdish and Turkish irregulars and the sorely outnumbered Armenians. At noon, De Nogales set out from Edremit for Van under escort. To right and left of the road circled screaming flocks of black vultures, disputing with the dogs the putrefied Armenian corpses thrown about on every side, he recalled. By the time he entered Van, the uprising was already 2 days old, and the old town was in the hands of the Armenian insurgents. The castle overlooking the old town remained in Ottoman hands, and from those heights Turkish forces were able to subject Armenian positions to artillery fire day and night. As an artillery officer, this duty now fell to De Nogales. He set up his headquarters in the castle's mosque and mounted its tall minaret to observe the accuracy of fire. For 21 days, De Nogales took part in the Ottoman campaign against the Armenians of Van. I have rarely seen such furious fighting as took place during the siege of Van, he reflected. Nobody gave quarter nor asked it. As the battle wore on, he witnessed atrocities committed by Armenians and Ottomans alike. His memoirs of the siege of Van swing between sympathy and revulsion for both sides. Russian forces slowly made their way from the Persian frontier, driving back the Ottomans in their effort to relieve the Armenian defenders in Van. For the Russians, the uprising facilitated their occupation of strategic Ottoman territory. The approach of Russian troops forced Chevdet Pasha to order the Muslims of Van to evacuate the city on 12 May. The last Ottoman soldiers withdrew from the citadel on 17 May. Armenians from the Garden District were finally able to link up with their compatriots in the old city. Together they set fire to the Muslim neighborhoods and all government buildings in advance of the arrival of the first Russian soldiers on 19 May. The Russians appointed the Dashnak leader, Arum Manukyan, as governor of Van. Manukyan established an Armenian administration in the town, complete with a militia and police force, measures that, in the words of an Armenian historian, stimulated the Armenian political consciousness and reinforced the convictions of those who foresaw a liberated and autonomous Armenia under Russian protection, everything the Ottomans most feared. The Turks, for their part, were not reconciled to the loss of Van and attacked Russian and Armenian positions relentlessly. The Russians, overextended, were driven into retreat. On 31 July, the Armenians were advised to prepare their belongings and abandon their homes. An estimated 100,000 Armenians withdrew with the Russians in what came to be known as the Great Retreat. Still, the Russians and Ottomans fought over Van, the town exchanging hands 3 times over the summer of 1915, before Russian forces captured and ultimately retained the town in the autumn of 1915, by which time very little of Van was left standing, and very few Armenians in eastern Anatolia were left alive. By facilitating the Russian occupation of Van in return for the right to govern the Van region, the Armenians had confirmed the Young Turks' suspicion that they constituted a fifth column and posed a threat to the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire. Moreover, the timing of the uprising, so close to the Allied landings at Gallipoli, convinced the Young Turks that the Armenians and the Entente powers had coordinated the attacks. As Jamal Pasha wrote in his memoirs, "A fact, in my opinion, absolutely irrefutable, is that at the moment when the Dardanelles campaign was at its crisis, the Armenians were ordered by the French and English commanders-in-chief of the forces in the eastern Mediterranean to rise." Though there is no evidence to support Jamal's allegations, the Unionists were convinced that the Armenians were in league with the Allies. With the fall of Van, the Ottomans began to implement a series of measures to eradicate the Armenian presence, not just from the six provinces of eastern Anatolia, but from Asiatic Turkey as a whole. The deportation of Armenians was conducted openly by government orders. The Young Turk leadership had secured an early recess of the Ottoman parliament on 1 March 1915, which left Interior Minister Talat Pasha and his colleagues a free hand to enact law without parlimentary debate. On 26 May 1915, within a week of the Russian entry into Van, Talat submitted a bill to the Ottoman Council of Ministers. The government swiftly approved Talat's deportation law, which allowed for the wholesale relocation of the Armenian population of the six provinces of eastern Anatolia to undisclosed locations away from the Russian front. At the end of May, the Interior Ministry issued orders to provincial and district governors bearing Talat's signature, calling for the immediate deportation of all Armenians. Announcements were posted in the main streets of towns and villages across eastern Anatolia, giving the local Armenian community between 3 and 5 days' notice of what was presented as a temporary relocation for the duration of the war. Armenians were encouraged to deposit any possessions they could not carry with the government for safekeeping. Alongside these publicly declared measures of forced displacement, the Young Turks issued secret orders for the mass murder of Armenian deportees. The extermination orders were not written down, but were communicated orally to provincial governors either by their author, CUP Central Committee member Dr. Bahaeddin Shakar, or by other CUP officials. Any provincial governor who asked for written confirmation of the orders or otherwise opposed the mass murder of unarmed civilians faced dismissal and even assassination. When one district governor in Diyarbakir province demanded written notice before carrying out the massacre of Armenians from his district, he was removed from office, summoned to Diyarbakir, and murdered en route. More compliant governors faced the task of recruiting armed gangs to kill the deportees. They were assisted by Enver's secret intelligence service, the Teşkilat-i Mahsusa, which mobilized violent criminals released from prison, Kurdish bands with a long history of antagonism towards the Armenians, and recent Muslim immigrants from the Balkans and Russian Caucasus to assist in the slaughter. Even average Turkish villagers were reported to have contributed to the killing of Armenian deportees, some to rob them of the clothing, money, and jewellery they had brought for their sustenance in exile, others because government officials had convinced them that the killing of Armenians contributed to the Ottoman jihad against the Entente powers. The Armenian priest, Grigoris Balekian, recounted a conversation with a Turkish captain who claimed government officials had sent gendarmes to all the surrounding Turkish villages and, in the name of Holy Jihad, invited the Muslim population to participate in this sacred religious obligation of massacring Armenians. Evidence of this two-track approach of an open deportation decree and secret annihilation orders came to light in the post-war testimony of government officials. A member of the Ottoman Council of Ministers testified in 1918, "I've learned of a few secrets and have come across something interesting. The deportation order was issued through official channels by the Minister of the Interior, that is, Talat, and sent to the provinces. Following this order, the CUP, Central Committee, circulated its own ominous order to all parties to allow the gangs to carry out their wretched task. Thus the gangs were in the field, ready for their atrocious slaughter. The massacres followed a standard pattern across Anatolia. A set number of days after deportation notices were posted, Armenians were driven from their homes by gendarmes with fixed bayonets. Males aged 12 and older were separated from their female relations and killed. In smaller villages, the men were often killed within sight or hearing of their horrified womenfolk, but in larger towns they were marched away to where their murder would not be witnessed, particularly by foreigners. After the Armenian men had been separated from them, the women and children were escorted out of town under armed guard. According to survivors' accounts, some of these caravans faced robbery and wholesale massacre. Others were marched from town to town, with the sick, infirm, and elderly killed as they fell behind. The ultimate destination for survivors were desert settlements in Syria and Iraq, Deir el-Zur, Deir Zor in Turkish, and Mosul, towns reached by perilous treks across open desert. The architects of the genocide, Talat and his advisers Dr. Mehmed Nazım and Dr. Bahadin Şakır, aimed to ensure that Armenians were driven entirely from the six eastern provinces and totaled no more than 10% of the population in any part of the empire. In this way, the Armenians would never attain the critical mass needed to secure independent statehood within Ottoman domains. Yet reaching this reduced demographic profile would require the annihilation of the vast majority of Ottoman Armenians. This was achieved through the combination of bloody massacres conducted by armed gangs and the high attrition rate through death marches across the desert. The Armenians of Erzurum and Erzincan were among the first to be deported in May 1915. After 2 months of marching, the survivors reached the town of Harput, some 125 miles away. The American consul there met with the deportees in the encampment the government provided for their short stay. There are very few men among them, as most of them have been killed on the road, Consul Leslie Davis noted. The system that is being followed seems to be to have bands of Kurds awaiting them on the road, to kill the men especially. The women were, almost without exception, ragged, filthy, hungry, and sick. That is not surprising in view of the fact that they have been on the road for nearly 2 months with no change of clothing, no chance to wash, no shelter, and little to eat. The starved women mobbed the guards who brought them food, only to be beaten back with clubs hard enough to kill them. Desperate mothers offered their children to the American consul in the hope that he might spare them from further horrors. By continuing to drive these people on in this way, it will be possible to dispose of all of them in a comparatively short time, Davis reflected. The entire movement seems to be the most thoroughly organized and effective massacre this country has ever seen. In June, Talat extended the deportation policy to all Armenians without exception in all eastern provinces of Anatolia. Towns like Erzincan, Sivas, Kayseri, Adana, Diyarbakir, and Aleppo became reception centers for waves of Armenian deportees destined for Deir al-Zur, Mosul, and Urfa. Each leg of the march was marked by unspeakable atrocities for the Armenian deportees. We were living through days of such unheard-of horror, it was impossible for the mind to fully comprehend, Father Grigoris Balakian recalled. Those of us still alive envied those who had already paid their inevitable dues of bloody torture and death. And so we survivors became living martyrs, every day dying a few deaths and returning to life again. Grigoris Balakian had made the firm decision to survive the annihilation of the Armenians in order to bear witness to the sufferings of his people for future generations. Taken from the comfort of his home in Istanbul on the eve of the Gallipoli landings, Balakian was dispatched with 150 other notables to the central Anatolian town of Çankırı, northeast of Ankara. When Talat issued his orders for the general deportation of Armenians on 21 June, Balakian negotiated a massive bribe of 1,500 gold pieces with the local officials to spare the small group of Armenians in Çankırı from deportation. The payment bought the Armenian priest and his companions a 7-month reprieve that spared them from the worst months of the massacres. Yet, when finally deported to Deir al-Zur in February 1916, Balakian and his comrades confronted gangs and villagers who had come to view the murder of Armenians with equanimity. Marching along the roads on which thousands of Armenians had already met their deaths, Balakian engaged the officers accompanying his caravan in conversation. The Ottoman gendarmes were willing to answer any questions, as they did not believe the Armenians they were guarding had long to live. One of the most forthcoming was Captain Shukri, who by his own admission had overseen the killing of 42,000 Armenians. "Bey, where have all these human bones along this road come from?" Balakian asked the captain disingenuously. "These are the bones of Armenians who were killed in August and September. The order had come from Constantinople, even though the Minister of the Interior, that is, Talat, had huge ditches dug for the corpses. The winter floods washed the dirt away, and now the bones are everywhere, as you see," Captain Shukri replied. "Upon whose orders were the massacres of Armenians committed?" Balakian probed. "The orders came from the Ittihad, that is, Unionist Central Committee and the Interior Ministry in Constantinople," Captain Shukri explained. "This order was carried out most severely by Kemal, vice-governor of Yozgat. When Kemal, a native of Van, heard that the Armenians had massacred all his family members at the time of the Van revolt, he sought revenge and massacred the women and children, together with the men." Balakian's questions did not upset the captain. He seemed to enjoy filling the long hours on the road in conversation with the Armenian priest, inured to the evil he recounted. Of the thousands of men hacked to death, of 6,400 Armenian women systematically robbed of their possessions and murdered along with their children, actions he consistently referred to as cleansing, paklamak in Turkish. The mass-murdering Ottoman officer even seemed to develop an affection for the Armenian priest, offering to protect him from all harm if only he would convert to Islam. Through conversations with Turkish officers, Balakian learned every aspect of the Armenian tragedy from the government's perspective. In his exchanges with survivors encountered along the way, the priest also deepened his knowledge of the Armenian experience of the genocide. He wove both perspectives together in his remarkable memoirs, first published in Armenian in 1922, thereby discharging his duty as a witness to what Balakian dubbed the Armenian Golgotha. Surviving the genocide was easier said than done. By preserving cordial relations with his captors and, in his own words, putting his trust in God, Balakian lived one day at a time, always at risk of sudden death. During the length of their forced march, the priest and his fellows confronted the magnitude of the horror that had befallen the Ottoman Armenian community, the bodies of the dead, the pleas of starving survivors, the shame of those who had converted to Islam to save their lives. He recorded the details in his diary as the caravan made its way across Anatolia to Cilicia, towards the Syrian desert. The accounts of other survivors of the Armenian genocide confirmed much of what he wrote. Fear of violent death that might come at any moment without warning compounded the daily experience of brutality, exhaustion, and deprivation. Many Armenians chose to take their own lives rather than face the cruelty of strangers. Even Grigoris Balakian, who had vowed to survive, was driven to contemplate suicide. When accosted by an armed gang near the Halis River, Balakian and his comrades agreed to dive into the torrential waters in the event of inescapable disaster, as many had done before them. Surely this deep grave of tens of thousands of Armenians would not refuse to take us, too, into its flowing, turbid currents, and save us from harrowing and cruel deaths at the hands of these Turkish criminals, he recalled. Only Balakian's presence of mind in negotiating the caravan's way past the gang spared them all on that occasion. Manuel Kerkasharian, who called himself M.K., was only a 9-year-old boy when he watched his mother dive from a bridge into the turbulent waters of the Euphrates. Natives of Adana, M.K.'s family had been deported to the Mesopotamian settlement of Ras El Ain in modern Syria. An only child, M.K. saw his family robbed by armed gangs and beaten by the gendarmes sent to escort them. His mother's feet swelled painfully from the extensive marching, but she struggled to keep up with the caravan, knowing the fate of those who fell behind. One night, when she knew she could walk no further, MK's mother made a terrible request of her husband. "Lead me to the river's edge. I am going to throw myself into the water. If I stay, the Arabs will kill me with torture." Her husband refused, but a neighbour understood her fears and carried MK's mother on his back to the banks of the swollen Euphrates. Her young son and a priest followed them to the river, but MK averted his eyes when she threw herself into the torrent. When he turned back, he saw his mother briefly before the current carried her away. Within 2 days of his mother's death, MK's father died in his sleep. The young boy was now an orphan, with no one to care for him. The barefoot boy's feet swelled until he was unable to walk. He watched as soldiers killed a number of women and children who, like him, had been left behind by the caravan. He was robbed of his remaining clothes down to his underpants and abandoned by the roadside alone, hungry, thirsty, and terrified. The Armenian priest, Grigoris Balekian, encountered many such orphans along the way. At Islahia, near where MK was orphaned, he encountered an 8-year-old boy begging with his 11-year-old sister, both nearly naked and dying from hunger. The elder sister explained, in a schoolgirl's proper Armenian, how all the other members of their family of 14 had died, leaving the 2 children to fend for themselves. "How I wish we hadn't survived," she sobbed. Buffeted by forces beyond his control, young Manuel Kerkasherian did survive. He found himself among Arabs and Kurds, people whose languages he did not speak and whose actions he did not understand. Some gave him food and clothing, others stoned and robbed him. He witnessed acts of terrible brutality and crossed plains covered with Armenian corpses. He was rescued by 4 Kurdish women who found him wandering on the open road and took him back to their village as a domestic servant. He spent the remainder of the war years moving among the Kurdish villages on the Turkish-Syrian frontier, living off the kindness and fleeing the cruelty of strangers. One evening, MK saw a distant hilltop village in flames. The Kurd then sheltering him explained it was the Assyrian village of Azak, one of several Christian villages being sacked. "Hey, child of disbelievers, did you see?" the Kurd gloated. "All of the Armenians of Turkey and all of the disbelievers of Turkey have been liquidated. The burning village is an infidel, Gaur village, and they are all being burned alive." The Kurd added that there were no Christians left in Turkey, just to scare MK. "And me," MK recalled, "I believed it." Like the Armenians, the Assyrian Christians of the Ottoman Empire were accused of making common cause with Russia at the outset of the Great War. The Assyrians are a Christian ethnic group who speak dialects derived from ancient Aramaic. For centuries they lived among the Kurdish communities in the border regions of the modern states of Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Iraq. The Nestorians, Chaldeans, and Syrian Orthodox Christians are the main Assyrian denominations. The Assyrian communities of the Ottoman Empire suffered from the same periodic massacres as the Armenians, including the events of 1895 and 1896, and the 1909 Adana killings. In search of great power protection, the Assyrians also put their trust in Russia. After the Ottoman entry into the Great War, the Assyrians were accused of collaboration with the Entente powers and targeted by the Young Turk regime for annihilation. An estimated 250,000 Assyrian Christians, out of a pre-war population of 620,000, were killed in the course of the First World War. For the child MK, it seemed credible that the Assyrians and Armenians might be eliminated entirely from Ottoman domains as part of one big plan. As he moved between the villages of southeastern Anatolia, MK encountered a number of Armenian children and young women who, like him, had taken refuge among the Kurds. Many had been collected from the death marches and taken to work in the homes and farms of the Kurdish villages. MK met several young Armenian women who had married into the families of their Kurdish protectors. That was how Herenush Gaderian survived the genocide. Hehrenyush was born into a respected family in the eastern Anatolian village of Habab, a large Armenian community of over 200 households, with two churches and a monastery. Her father and two